Thanks for joining us. This is episode 12 of the Golf Talk Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. This is, unfortunately, take two. Welcome back, I could say, Jeff in Washington and Everardo in the state with a crappy football team.
Again, I will acknowledge that we have a football team. So
they do. They're called the Cardinals.
No, we have soccer.
Again, we acknowledge that you do have some self-respect.
Well, I guess calling them a football team is a stretch.
We have a professional stadium. And we have two college teams.
That's right.
How's that?
And you hosted the Super Bowl the last time the Steelers were there, I think.
Yeah.
The Arizona Pee-wees?
It was
That's the only football game I've ever been to.
It wasn't this game, though.
22 seconds remaining. And Bradshaw is back and looking again. Bradshaw running out of the pocket. Looking for somebody to throw to. Fires it downfield. And there's a collision.
Yes, the Immaculate Deception.
The segue being the look on some of the Raiders' faces when Franco Harris picked the ball out of the air. The look on some of the Raiders' faces was one of disbelief and shock, which was about the same look that Jose Maria Olazabal had when Tiger Woods made it into a playoff, where he eventually beat Jose Maria Olazabal with two pars.
And a guy named Green, Nathan Green, yes?
Yeah, I don't know, some guy, whatever.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, it's a choke factor. People are still choking around Tiger. We thought all this time, and last year, again, we go back to 2004, and everyone saw Tiger's not the player he used to be, and can he ever recapture his form? And here he is again, just making people crap their pants.
Right. There you go. 17.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is when he plays like crap,
yeah. Go ahead.
When he plays like crap, I mean, other players have to step up their game because it's still not good enough.
Well, Tiger, I think, I mean, I would have given him a C-plus for his play. I mean, he really wasn't on top of his game. You know, he was at minus 10 going into the day and shot even par, I think, that's not great.
But again, he can close and he can get it done on the stretch.
Everybody was trying to lose that tournament. He was one of the few people that, I mean, I wouldn't say went out and won it, but he held it together at least.
Hey, and I give him some credit, too, because this guy, I mean, he's disappointed. Olazabal misses the putt. Like Eric, you referred to in our last podcast, Daly misses a three-footer, and he hangs his head. He thinks, come on, guy, you know, let me win it with a birdie. Let me win it, you know, actually take it.
Right. Part of me, seriously, though, you know, I'm a Tiger fan, but part of me wonders how much of that is acting. Because, you know, you don't want to be seen as taking delight in someone else's failure. Tiger Woods is nothing if he's not aware of, you know, media cameras. Certainly he is, and how he's perceived. So part of me, maybe I'm a little cynical. Part of me wonders if a lot of that's, or at least a significant portion of that is acting.
Where he's, I would think, with as competitive as he is, that he wants to earn the win.
Yeah,
well, I mean, you earn the win by getting into the playoff and, you know, not doing something stupid like make a bogey too. You know, you can look at it that way.
I'm of the opinion that he's happy to have the win, but I think he wants to win it. I think he wants to win it with a birdie. I think he's disappointed, as he said, for his friends on tour who give the tournament away.
Moving on, Michael Campbell. Apparently in 2003 did not play 15 tournaments as required by the PGA Tour. He only played 14. So for the next 5 years through 2008, he has a limited schedule. He can only play 10 events. Those 10 events probably, most likely for the rest of his career being, or through 2008 being, the four majors, three World Golf Championship events, the Players' Championship, that's eight. And then he's got two more, so he can use those on the Memorial and the Colonial or two other tournaments. I think he played in the Mercedes Championship, right?
Yes, and that counts.
So that was one of them. So now he only has one tournament outside of those other eight to play this year.
Seemed to me from something that he said that he was not going to be able to play the Memorial, which was a disappointment to him. So he's getting cut out a little bit.
So, I mean, stupid mistake, not looking ahead. What is this, you know? 2003, he obviously hadn't won a U.S. Open back then.
But I think that was kind of the time in his career, too, where he was wanting to give up golf or quit golf. So he probably didn't just think about the future. And, hey, if I just play one more tournament, you know, that keeps me in the loop. But, you know, he's such a world traveler, too, that 10 events on this side plus all the other events that he travels for might just be enough for him anyways.
It could be.
It's what, a 22-hour flight or something to New Zealand? So
you sleep on it.
Hopefully,
or
yeah.
You listen to our podcast.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us, Michael.
That was much shorter. See, we're much shorter the second time around.
Okay.
Much more concise.
Yeah,
we'll be right back after this word from Titleist.
To hit the ball more solid off the tee, you need to swing at a pace you can't control and catch the ball right in the middle of the club face.
You want to hit it a little bit longer, try moving it up in your stance just a little.
You got to complete your backswing.
Try a little pause at the top.
Try a bigger shoulder turn.
Grip it more in the fingers and less in the palm.
If you want to hit it big, you got to swing big.
And the most important tip of all,
trust your tight list.
You can learn a lot from the world's best players.
That was a good shot, too.
Thank you, Tyler. This week, GolfGods.com is going to be talking in their Chip Shop segment about rangefinders. We have a couple of reviews on our website, but summary, I like mine. I have a Pinseeker 1500 by Bushnell. It's the one with the slope, but I turned that off because it's pretty much useless anyway. You know, what do you guys think?
I have one, and I love it. I think it's great for practice. I never use it during the round. For practice, it really helps me tune into what a particular yardage is.
Why don't you use it during a round?
I think I play a little bit faster without it. I mean, I know it's supposed to help speed up play, but I kind of like the idea that if I can learn the yardage while I'm practicing, then out on the course, I can have a better picture of what that yardage is supposed to be now.
Fair enough.
You know what I think?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, for me, I don't have one, but after playing again today, it would be really nice. Because I don't, you know, it's like slogging around in the mush, trying to find, something that says how far away you are, then pace it off. The advantages, I think, are pretty big.
Just to speed it up.
Just to speed things up, and I could see.
You don't necessarily have to hit your irons the exact yardage. You know, I mean, the difference between 126 for you, Jeff, and 130... It's only 4 yards, but that might be a change of a club for you.
Yeah. Well, so, there's a cutoff there somewhere where you've got to say, I need a 7-iron, I need an 8-iron, and that would really help.
Right.
Well, and the reason why I don't use it a lot during a round is I concentrate more on the center of the green than I do the pin, especially if the pin's right in front or right next to a bunk or something like that. Then I'm pretty much going to ballpark it to whatever club's going to get me to the center of that green.
The only disadvantage I can see is that if you're riding, you know, I'm always juggling clubs when I'm riding anyway, and to have something else to worry about. If I'm carrying, it's right there with me, no big deal, but I can see that being a problem.
Fair enough. We'll let Golf Gods actually tell us what they think now. So we'll be right back.
From the studios of GolfGods.com in Minneapolis, this is Chip Shots, a weekly look at golf equipment news, brought to you by the staff of GolfGods.com, the official online pro shop of thesandtrap.com. This week on Chip Shots, Battle of the Rangefinders. One product category outside of hard goods, which is making a significant impact both on the course and off the course, is rangefinders, both of the laser and GPS variety. On the heels of the USGA and RA's decision to allow rangefinders as a condition of competition, the 2006 PGA show featured a buzz of activity and new entrants into both categories. Here's what Team Golf Gods saw at the show. The two heavyweights slugging it out were Bushnell, makers of the popular Pinseeker series of laser rangefinders, and SkyGolf, the leading GPS solution. Ironically, these two companies were positioned only an aisle apart at the show. While there was plenty of sniping between the two, there appeared to be enough buyers to go around for both companies. Surprisingly, both companies are struggling to keep pace with demand now that each has a solution that's legal for tournament play. On the GPS side, no less than 6 other companies have entered the fray. While SkyGolf enjoys an iPod-like advantage over these upstarts, innovations in form factor and features will likely revolutionize the category and business model. With over 8,000 courses mapped and affiliations with some top pros on the PGA and LPGA tours, we suspect SkyGolf will be up to the challenge. While no major product changes occurred with the Bushnell line, the rules of golf are having a significant impact on which models are being gobbled up by the golfing public. Previously, the Pinseeker 1500 with slope was the king of the hill. The addition of slope provides for compensated range, which, as you can imagine, is quite handy during a round of golf. The catch now is the slope versions are not legal for tournament play, making the Pinseeker 1500 the choice of tournament players. Bushnell has also rebranded and reintroduced the Yardage Pro Tour 500 at the $199 price point for those seeking value. If you're not using either technology when you play, you're missing a tool in your bag that could be even more powerful than the latest driver. Not only do these products dramatically improve the speed of play, the instant and accurate information gives even the high handicapper more time to focus on club selection and course management. If it's any clue to the effectiveness, last year on the Tight Lies Tour, 12 of the 15 top money winners used SkyCaddy to measure distances. As they say, if it's good enough for the goose, it's good enough for the gander. That's it for Chip Shots this week, brought to you by the staff at GolfGods.com. the official online pro shop of thesandtrap.com. Now back to this week's podcast.
Welcome back. In this week's listener forum topic, we have some babble about a double cut. We're still not exactly sure what the deal is here, but one of our forum members, Frank, proposed that basically they cut instead of the low 70 in ties, the low 50 in ties advance to the weekend, but everyone that finishes from 50th to 70th gets paid 50th place money, I think.
I think the idea is that those 20 who now get cut, they still get some money towards, the earnings. But
they get that money anyway if they make the cut.
Exactly.
But now they don't have to play.
Yeah, right. They just get to go home.
It's another, a night less in the hotel.
Yeah, I'm not jumping on the bandwagon at all. I think there's a lot more questions there than answers.
So we'll link to it, but the basics are, I remember last year, but Brad Faxon won a tournament last year after not winning in, 6 years or whatever it was. But he made the cut on the number. So he was in dead last place with two rounds to go and ended up winning the tournament. So if nothing else, telling the guys from 50th to 70th to shove off would remove that possibility from them.
Well, and the thing is, my thought is, if you're going to pay those guys, then you might as well let them play. Because right. His idea is to also speed up pace of play, or that should be one side effect of it. But, 20 guys, is that really going to speed up an event that much more? No.
I think John Daly would like the idea, though.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't want any practice rounds.
Yeah, he could just make the cut and then go home.
Yeah.
Basically. He wouldn't have to, leave in the middle of a round or something. But
yeah.
We invited Frank onto our podcast. Frank, apparently, he didn't even respond, so...
I think we can say that's an open invitation, Frank. Right. If you want to come on and explain it to us, have at it.
Please.
Because we don't know what the hell you're talking about, so feel free to come on and enlighten us. We welcome it. We also welcome this ad, and then we'll be right back.
For a crisper long iron, grip up on it about an inch.
Be real aggressive through impact.
Keep it short and aggressive.
Maintain your balance.
Take one more club and swing it smooth.
Think Abby Thorns.
For a soft draw, close your stance and make sure you release the club.
I'm going to lounge my feet to the right a little bit, hook the club face, then grip the club.
You can learn a lot from the world's best players.
And one more tip, trust your tightness.
Oh, that's got to be it, guys. Come on, that's a perfect shot.
Thank you once again for Titleist. Thanks to Titleist for sponsoring the Sand Trap, long time sponsor, and we're happy to have him. Everardo is apparently a beat poet now, so... That's nice, because this is Beating Balls.
There we go.
This is our quick segment. Colin Montgomery is apparently going through an expensive divorce. Not going through, but the terms or something recently came out. And he's blaming his recent poor play on his, 8 million to 15 million pound divorce.
It's the price of a nut that he had to pay her.
Right. And his wife was pretty attractive looking, not worth 8 to 15 million pounds, which is, pounds are usually what, about 1.7 to the dollar, or the other way around. So 15 to 25 million dollars, basically, I think.
Yeah, it's a huge chunk of change.
It's a lot.
Well, he struggled when the divorce was kind of going on, and he's right in the middle of it. It's understandable.
A year and a half or 2 years ago. But now he's blaming poor play on, basically writing a big check. So I don't know. It seems to me he's kind of looking for an excuse. Maybe it's a good one, but, I've never had to write a check for $8 million to anyone, let alone, 15 to 25 million or so.
That would depress me.
Yeah, that would affect me.
Whether
I have it to give or not.
That's what I think.
That would still hurt.
If I was professional golfer and I had to write a big check for a lot of people, I think I would try to take this motivation to go win some back.
Yeah, there you go.
And he didn't do it that way, so to Mrs. Doubtfire. Speaking of, we're going to go to the Abu Dhabi officials, the European Tour Players Committee. Basically, Ian Poulter wore an Arsenal shirt. I think it was a traditional golf shirt, polo shirt, with a collar and everything, but he had the Arsenal football team soccer in England. He had their logo on the front. Apparently people thought that was in poor taste or something, so they were talking about possibly fining him.
Which I really don't get, and kind of like I mentioned in the first podcast, is it's an O2 logo. It's not like it's huge or obnoxious. It's still a polo shirt. It's not, I think I said it wasn't even as crazy of a design as like some of the Jay Lindbergh stuff that Hank Keeney wears and others. So what's the big deal? It's not like he's advertising something against golf, and it's not like it's, I don't know. I don't think it's that distracting at all, and I don't see how it's offensive.
Well, with other players, you know, running around looking like, you know, NASCAR drivers, John Daly, and everybody's got a logo on their hat, so
right.
Hello.
And although no one cares about him, but Ben Curtis is always wearing some sort of pro NFL logo stuff, a hat, a shirt, wearing the team colors of the Browns, so on and so forth.
So is Payne Stewart.
Yeah.
But that was, I'd say, that's wearing the team colors, you know. I mean, this is, I mean, we'll be honest, I mean, it's a foot, you know, 8-inch, 10-inch, you know, big O on a shirt. But it, you know what, if the two weren't there, the two and the O2, you could almost call that the design of the shirt, you know. So,
yeah,
right? It's just a design on a shirt. I mean, what's his name? Woody Austin wears worse looking shirts than this. Duffy Waldorf, you know, I mean.
Yeah, some of those guys in the Champions Tour, they wear all those crazy shirts, so.
That's right. Well, they're seen now, they're allowed. So.
That's right.
But, from the Common Sense Department here, we have a survey. I'll have a link to this, if, like I said. According to a survey conducted by Golf Digest and Golf for Women, male golfers are 18 times more likely than a female golfer to break a club in anger, but women are 19 times more likely to cry. So
I really hope they didn't spend a lot of money on this stupid thing.
Groundbreaking news.
Right. This is.
I'm a changed man.
Right. So that just makes men that cry playing golf that much worse.
Right.
That's where our subscription money goes.
Right, into paying for things like this. This is, I think this was a government survey, because...
That sounds like a government kind of a survey. Yes, it does.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
The government is likely to pay $500 for the driver these days. I mean, they're cheaper than screwdrivers, right? So, there you go. Also,
gold.
Also, yes, both men and women swear about the same amount, but... Now get this, hold on to your nuts for this one. Men tend to drink alcohol and gamble more. Around them.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Men gamble.
Who would have ever thunk it?
And drink.
Yeah.
And break clubs.
And men tend to don't wear skirts as much as women.
Right.
Right.
Unless you're Fred Funk.
Okay, that's fine. What? What? Next.
I don't know. 17 million to one odds. Two brothers made holes in one on the same hole. The names are Chiang Hock Wu and Chiang Hock Tu. Unfortunately, I think two went first.
Yes.
Because his ball was beneath Wu's ball. His golf ball, anyway. So, two brothers make holes in one on the same hole in the same foursome. Obviously on the same day and all that. 17 million to one odds. I seem to recall a husband and a wife doing something like this last year. Do you guys remember that story?
Well, I remember the guy who had two hole-in-ones at the same course, like back-to-back.
At Pebble Beach, the guy in the Lexus event had two holes in one in the same round. But I seem to remember a husband and a wife doing something like this last year. There's a quote here at the bottom of the article that we'll link to. Wu and Tu, after hearing this tale of a cheap bastard named Jeff, who did not buy drinks for anyone after his hole-in-one.
There we go.
Bought around for everyone at the golf course. I don't know who this Jeff could be. Jeff, do you know?
No, I don't. Eberardo, yeah, you can tell your story too.
Go ahead. I actually got to meet Jeff yesterday for the first time, and he made me buy drinks, too.
Yes, they met up for drinks, and Jeff didn't even pick up the tab then.
I'd like to let our listeners know this is pure crap. Everardo's a generous man.
Jeff?
Wouldn't let me pay.
Jeff, a pastor, is apparently not atoning for his earlier sin of, you know, stiffing the golf community.
Not opposed to receiving gifts.
Well, you're apparently opposed to giving them.
Right.
The golf gods, no pun intended, with one of our sponsors, deem you worthy of a hole-in-one, and then you stiff the golf world by not, you know, offering up a drink to the one person you had to give
to. That's the thing, it was one person.
One guy, and he couldn't even buy drinks. So it wasn't like you're worried about your budget here.
I've offered up more beaver pelts than most players in their whole lifetime. So it's all silent.
We're talking about gimmicks now, or
just
golf for women?
You just need to know. You just need to know that anyway.
We just need to know you're a cheap bastard. Hopefully you're not a slow bastard. We're going to link to an article on pace of play, and basically I remember years ago people were talking about rating a course's speed, how fast you were supposed to play a course. Basically, you know, your average par 3 takes, say, 12 minutes. If there's a water hazard, maybe add 2 minutes. You know, you add all those up, the walks between tees and greens and so on. And you arrive at, you know, 3 hours and 17 minutes or something. How long a course should take to play. You know, of course, then you add 2 hours to that to be practical, and nobody follows the thing anyway. But, you know, we'll link to something about this. Pace of play is, you know, is a big issue. I like, whenever you have these on your course, the clocks that say, you know, if your tee time was 1 o'clock, they'll set like the clock on the 17th or the 7th tee back, you know, an hour and a half or something and say, you should be here by your starting time.
Yeah.
Or things like that. Or, you know, if you tee off at 1, it says you should be here by 2:30.
Which admittedly does get kind of confusing for some, but at least it's something that kind of points out to people. At least that makes them conscious if they see clocks. Hopefully.
Well, it's an important enough issue that it's an important educational thing. It's important as it is to know how to swing the club. You got to learn how to play fast.
Well, what's interesting, too, is people who think they play fast but really play slow, you know.
Right.
And that was part of the survey that this guy did, too, was saying that after interviewing so many people, they all thought that they played pretty fast. And after timing them, they actually played pretty slow.
Yeah, here are the numbers. How would you rate your own pace of play? 58% said they play fast. How would you rate most golfers' pace of play? 57% said slow. Obviously, there's, you know, you don't have to be a numbers genius to figure out that there's a little disconnect there.
One thing that is kind of funny I'll point out is he actually followed groups at Torrey Pines and then at Pebble Beach, and he actually walked up to him, presented himself that he was from the OCA, and told him about their pace of play being slow. And one of the guys says, hey, look, if I'm paying $450 for a round at Pebble Beach, I'm going to enjoy it.
Fair enough.
Right.
But that doesn't really excuse the people paying $5 at the local muni.
Absolutely.
We asked this question last week, and you weren't here, Everardo. You were on a business trip. If you were the czar of the PGA Tour, what would you do to speed up pace of play?
I'd find players. Not money, with strokes. Because if you just find them for money, which they have been doing, I mean, who cares if they pay $5,000, $10,000? But you find them with strokes where they can actually lose money or lose places in the tournament. That affects them more than just the dollar. Because now it gets their score and their dollar.
Right. Well, you can find them strokes. It's like, what, the third or fourth offense, which almost nobody ever reaches.
Right.
So there you go. We're going to listen to, we're going to link to an article from talking about a stupid reporter that asked Bill Murray why they never filmed Caddyshack 2. Obvious thing being that they did film Caddyshack 2, and Bill Murray realized it was probably going to be a stink fest and didn't participate in it.
So he says to the guy, Gunga Galunga.
He says to the guy, Dangerfield's dead. That's one reason.
Yep. I'm trying to work in a Jeff being cheap joke, but it's just not funny.
Yeah.
So I'll let that go this time.
Thank you so very much.
I'm not going to let this go. I'm going to do this here. Sorry.
No.
Here we go. Here we go. Steelers, here we go. Pittsburgh's gone to Super Bowl.
So the bet is that Jeff has to sing that song in next week's podcast.
I believe this is going to be a good game, by the way.
There's no need to make a corollary bet because that, you know, it's just going to happen.
Well, imagine the collective look on people's faces, the deer caught in the headlights look, should the Seattle Seahawks win this one.
How many games did they win away against the team with a winning record this year?
It just doesn't matter.
It's the same number as your bar tab after your hole-in-one.
It's the Seahawks.
Zero.
Should they win?
Zero.
Will shock the nation.
The Seahawks, should they win? Well,
they will, because they, as many gambling sites have them, as a 16% chance of winning.
There you go.
It would be a Monet, a masterpiece.
Well, the thing is, the Steelers are coached by Bill Cowher, so you guys have a much bigger, better chance than you realize. Not necessarily of winning, but of the Steelers losing, because their coach is a dumbass.
Thank you. He'll retire. Your generosity,
Eric. 16%, that's low. I think it'll be a close game, but, you know, Bill Cowher likes the turtle, and there you go. But, you know, I mean, it's the Super Bowl, so one mistake early and, you know, could be the game. And either team can make that. So, you know,
I just watch the commercials.
I just like to give a little crap to Jeff, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. And, you know, like I said, in the end, we're just happy we're not Cardinals fans.
So, I'm glad I'm not either.
Thanks for joining us on this episode 12 of the Golf Type Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. Again, thesandtrap.com. If you want to join our forum, you can do that at thesandtrap.com/forum, or, you know, search for it, or, you know, use Google, or, you know, Divine Intervention or something. Again, Jeff could probably help you out with that. Just don't ask him to buy you a drink. Thanks again, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care, guys. Bye.